The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. With our broadband, your world is limitless. Live beyond.
It is coming up to 25 to 10, the international best-selling debut novel of my guest this morning, The Tattooist of Auschwitz, featured a character who had a story so compelling that became the focus of what is essentially a follow-up called Silke's Journey. The author is Heather Morris. Heather, good morning and nice to talk to you again.
Good morning, Ryan. Yes, lovely to be talking back with you.
You must be the busiest woman in the literary world at the moment because the book is flying off the shelves. I mean, certainly Silke's Journey, but also The Tattooist. Are you surprised by the interest and the enjoyment people are getting from the books?
Yes, I am at one level and not at another. When I've written the stories, because I've written stories which resonate with people in terms of individuals who survived and had courage beyond measure, people are relating their courage to things that are going on in their own lives. And so, yes, they are resonating with them. And I should have expected that, but I didn't.
Yes.
I'm delighted.
Yes.
And, very, very overwhelmed by it all.
I think, I suppose, if we talk about The Tattooist of Auschwitz for a moment, it's the accessibility of the storytelling that probably appeals to people. But also, there seems to be, for whatever reason, since World War II, a fascination with this period in time. I mean, even children, I can see it in the next generation coming up. They're horrified, but they're intrigued.
Look, I'd like to think that they're intrigued because they can't believe that it happened once.
Yes.
And we definitely can't let it happen again.
Yes.
Delighted. I've had children as young as 9 write to me who have read The Tattooist.
And what sort
Many, many teenagers.
And what sort of thing do the younger people want to ask you?
Or often they've ended up with, would you please write to my mum and dad and ask them they to take me to Auschwitz? Tell them they have to.
Really? They want to go and see it for themselves?
They want to go and see it for themselves, and that is that's when I know the message has got through.
Good. And that's great, because that's history and that's the past and that's education, so it's all good news in that sense. Before we talk about Silke's Journey, if you wouldn't mind, Heather, could you give us just a snapshot of The Tattooist of Auschwitz again, even though we spoke about it, but just for people who haven't read it, so that that'll inform our conversation this morning.
Absolutely. And I'll start by saying that he was a 25-year-old man when taken into Auschwitz-Birkenau from a small town in Slovakia. He was a Jewish man. And after he survived typhus after a few weeks only, he was given a role as the assistant tattooist, tätowera, as he called it. Mm-hmm. When the tattooist, Pepin, disappeared, he became the tätowera in Auschwitz-Birkenau. One day he held the arm of a young 18-year-old girl, dressed in rags and her head shaven, and he stabbed numbers into her arm. And he would tell me 60 years later that he knew in that second he would never love another, and he didn't. And it's a story of their survival in the camp. And of course, at the end, I wrap it all up by telling you that they lived for another 50-plus years in Australia very, very happily.
Extraordinary story, and thank you for that, because that gives us an idea of where we go from there, because I suppose Lally, thank you. Lally regarded Silke of Silke's Journey as the bravest person he had ever met. And
yeah.
We need to get put Silke into context, and I always think when we're talking about history, and this is a historical fiction. We'll get to that in a minute. But Silke, somebody called Silke did exist. And I always think we need to look at them pre-concentration camp and then during and post. There's three points in their lives. So pre-concentration camp, what sort of a person was she? What life was she living?
I just told you that Lally was a 25-year-old man. Silke was a 16-year-old girl.
Yeah.
She turned 16 in March 1942, and a month later, she was in Auschwitz. I've been to the very town that she came from in Slovakia, a small little town, beautiful town, and stood outside the very door where she and her family were living until that fateful day they were all taken away. And so for this young 16-year-old girl, innocent, she hadn't been able to be educated for nearly 2 years. She only knew her family in this very small environment. What would prepare her under those circumstances to then survive not only her time in Auschwitz, but then to go on and spend 10 years in a Siberian gulag? I can only put it down to an incredible strength of character. And what I have learned from people who knew her, who I've met, her friends and neighbours back in Kosciuszko, is that she was the girl, the youngest of three sisters. But she was the tomboy. She was the strong one. She had to rule the house. So I can only imagine that kind of strength that came from being the baby actually gave her that ability to, I will survive.
So she gets to Auschwitz, and what class of experience did she have there? Can you fill us in on all of that, Heather?
Like all the girls, they were initially in Auschwitz and then they got moved to Birkenau. And there, the commandant took a fancy to her, singled her out. And there's only one way to describe the next 2.5 years for her. She was placed as the block leader in Block 25, the most infamous block in all the women's camp. And there, she survived by being raped. So call it what it was. She was raped whenever Short Super felt the need. The block that she was in, Block 25, can I tell you what that was about?
Please do, yeah.
It was the block where every afternoon or evening, all the women in the women's camp, and we're talking tens of thousands, mm-hmm. they would fill that block with women for whom that was going to be their last night on earth. They were the ones who were too sick or just were not working, and they were deemed to be instantly disposable, and they were taken from all their respective blocks, put in Block 25, and the next morning taken to the gas chamber. And that's where he placed Silke in the one single room in that block. So there would be no witnesses. There could never be a witness to what was going on with her.
It's funny because people say, oh, she was a concubine of an SS camp soldier. And really, she was a rape victim, perpetually.
Yeah, she was a sex slave, rape victim, absolutely.
And in the Block 25 you describe, what was her role there?
Pretty much during the day to do nothing. And then at night time or in the late afternoon, women were being sent there or brought there by their block leaders and capos. And all she had to do really was just keep them in that block overnight and the next morning open the doors. And she did, in some ways, escort them onto the trucks that took them to the gas chamber.
This is where we start getting into that awful sense of collaboration, forced labour roles, if you like. And in your research, Heather, you would have found conflicting comments. That some people, that she yelled and screamed at some of the women sometimes,
yeah.
That she smuggled food when somebody was dying of hunger. We will never comprehend in our lifetime, obviously, or we'll never be able to, as students of history, what a place like that does to the human condition. But you got conflicting stories about Silke, is that fair to say?
Oh, absolutely. And this whole notion of her being heard yelling and screaming at the women and
yes.
even in some instances pushing them around. But I know from not only seeing and listening to Gita's shower tape, but speaking to other survivors in Melbourne who were there and knew what was going on, they all told me she did that so that she could keep the SS out of the block. She was doing that in some ways to prevent them being beaten more harshly by SS. And so when they were being let out, if anyone stumbled or tripped getting onto the truck, and these were women too weak to barely move, she would go over and yell at them, get up, and force them onto the truck, because if she didn't do it by yelling, you can bet an SS would do it with his swagger stick or the end of his rifle.
So she was playing a role.
She thought she was, in some ways, she was playing a role trying to... She couldn't save these women. That was not going to happen. But she could prevent them from being beaten further.
She survived Birkenau. And you would think, well, okay, you do what you need to do to survive. And she got out of there. You would think you would hope at the loving arms of a family waiting for her or what have you. But this is why your book it takes this gruesome turn. Tell us what happens when the gates are open.
The gates are open, the Red Army arrive, they've liberated the camp. She's liberated, or so she would have thought. However, somebody pointed the finger at her, and she was charged with prostituting herself to the enemy. Oh, and apparently she must be a spy because she spoke three languages. I mean, how absurd is that? You know, I was talking at an event last night and I was talking to a woman afterwards and she said that she was from Slovakia, and I'd mentioned this whole notion of her being a spy because she spoke multiple languages. And this woman said, I'm from Slovakia. I speak five languages.
Yeah.
It's just what we are. And so, yes, well, now she finds herself, you know, charged, convicted, and then sent to a Siberian gulag. The prison sentence was 15 years. She was there for 10. In the worst place on earth, the coldest place on earth, 160 kilometres inside the Arctic Circle, where the permafrost was 6 feet deep in the middle of summer. That was her life for 10 years.
And what does the gulag life, I mean, we use the word gulag now nearly almost in a term of derision if you're sending somebody somewhere like Siberia and what have you. But what can you tell us about the day-to-day there?
I was very specific when I engaged a researcher in Moscow. Find me information about Vorkuta only. I do not want to know about any other gulag. I need to be very specific if I was going to describe this environment. And she did. So that is the only gulag I can talk about, because then when I want to. It was a coal mining area. It still is today. That's how big the coal mountains are there, if I can call them that.
Sure.
Now, at one point, I read that there were 32 different nationalities at Vorkuta. They called themselves the United Nations. But here's the thing about those gulags, in some ways. They were kind of like the first equal opportunity, well, I won't use the word employer.
Yeah.
Because they treated men and women the same. They punished them the same. They fed them the same. They worked them the same. But where it differed was the sexual abuse. Now, that wasn't the same.
In what sense? Obviously, you're going to get an idea.
In one sense, that's where the women were singled out.
Yes.
And any woman, and men outnumbered the women significantly at all times. And so, yes, women became once again the sex slaves, but here, not of their captors. This is the weird thing.
Yeah.
While the Russians or the Soviets oversaw the running of the gulag, senior prisoners, prisoners who had been there a while, they actually got a role where they were the quasi-guards.
Mm-hmm.
But a little bit like the SS, then they used the Jews to do all their own dirty work. But once again, it was other prisoners, senior prisoners, who ran the gulag. And as long as everything was going fine and they were just rorting it, abusing it, it wasn't like in any way Auschwitz-Birkenau, where the camps were all totally separated, men and women didn't mix, because they were just fodder. They were all fodder.
And she emerged from the gulag to what?
Well, she was released in 1955 when, can I say it, thankfully Stalin died.
Mm-hmm.
And Khrushchev came to power, and he was, from what I understand, was then trying to get on with the West a little bit better. And he decided to release a lot of the prisoners in gulags who were not Soviet citizens. And Silke and the man that she had met and was falling in love with, they were both put on the same train on the same day to travel back to Prague, because they were being handed over to their country. Now, when they did get back to Prague, they were handed over to the authorities there. And I'm told they then were imprisoned for another 12 months. Because they had come from the Soviet Union and they were considered prisoners. So the Czech authorities imprisoned them. And after 12 months, they went, really, we've got nothing to hold these guys on, and released them. She and the man that she'd fallen in love with then travelled back to Slovakia, her hometown, to Košice. Now, here's an interesting little aside in terms of Silke.
Mm-hmm.
All the research and archive areas that we've looked into, from Yad Vashem to the Auschwitz Museum, the United States Holocaust Center, when you find her name, you see the words written beside it, murdered in Auschwitz.
Really?
Everyone in the authorities or the authoritative organizations have hers being dead. And when you see that and you go, but I know she wasn't, because I know that Lally's wife, Gita, visited her and corresponded with her, and other women in Melbourne I met did the same. And so how do I prove to all these organisations that she is in fact still alive, or still was alive? And I found my proof just in June on my last visit to her hometown. And I went, well, it wasn't her hometown, it was the town she was born in. And the bureaucrats there agreed to let me see her birth registration. It's a huge, big book, a journal, and it's beautifully written. I love it. And at the end of her birth details, there was a couple of sentences, and I couldn't read them, so I asked the translator, you know, what does that mean? Because I thought I saw the date 1958. And when they translated that to me, it said that Cecilia Klein had presented to this office on this day in 1958, bringing with her the relevant documents from Bratislava, declaring her now to be a legal citizen of the state of Czechoslovakia.
So you found her. This is the diamond in the rough. And
she had gone to that trouble and effort to go back to this town where she was born and have that notate. And I said to the bureaucrat, why would she do that? She said, she probably had to do that if she was going to either work or get married. She would need to prove that she was still alive.
How long did she live for?
She lived until she was 78. She died in 2004.
Great. It's amazing, isn't it, really, when you think of how recent it was. And Heather, how are you responding to the controversy about the book? You know, the Auschwitz Memorial Research Centre saying that they're not so sure about the veracity or of the book, in the sense that they're not confused, they don't like the history and fiction mixing like this. Are you troubled by that?
Look, they do amazing work and have done for decades and will do for decades to come. But what I've done, and I think I'm probably the only person who has done this, particularly in regard to Silke, is that they have the facts there that are freely available, and I thank them for them. But my sources are people who knew her, people who knew her in Auschwitz, Birkenau, her friends and neighbours who knew her for five decades back in Slovakia. And from them, I have learnt the story that I have written. So I've chosen to go to sources who knew her at an individual basis, not at the big level.
But you say it is a novel that and does not represent the entire facts of Silke's life. Does that mean that we can assume that you have brought other characters or other aspects of her character into what is essentially a novel?
Oh, absolutely. But there is some very significant changes that I have made to weave together the story of what her life in the Gulag would be like. But the people in it, the ones who count, are people who I know were in her life because people who I spoke to told me about them. In particular, the doctor, the female doctor from Georgia. That person was real. She existed. She existed to the extent that Silke visited her back in the Soviet Union, still under communist rule, several times. So grateful was she to this woman for saving her life.
And did it bother you when this happened? When, as I say, the Auschwitz Centre came out against the book as they saw it? Were you perturbed by that?
Oh, how could I not be? You take a hit. But I come back to the same criticisms of Lully's story, that there are inaccuracies in there, the whole notion of history and memory. And yes, they often pull apart, but they also dance and step more times than they pull apart.
But should we be reading Silke's journey as historical fiction?
Based on a real woman, real circumstances, everything that I've described in her story about the Gulag is as I have been given from research and also by the testimony of brave, brave women who were in that very Gulag, who have done testimonies, and they have described their life on a day-to-day basis in that Gulag, and it's the life that Silke would have been living also.
I think
No question.
And I appreciate that entirely. And I think also one thing that this book brings to life so critically is the idea of rape as a war crime. And I say that in light of more recent wars in Bosnia and the Balkan conflagration, where, you know, it wasn't really discussed. And if you've read, you know, Anthony Beaver's books, as I'm sure you have, the rape as a war crime from the Red Army coming across and into Berlin, and equally from the Germans crossing from the West into Russia, it is one of those subplots in history that needed to become center stage. And thankfully, with books like this and conversations like this, suddenly a lot of people are getting their voice where they didn't have it before.
Well, this conversation has got to just actually now, you know, explode. It has to. Yeah. No longer can women be considered the spoils of war. Not just women, girls.
Yes.
Young girls.
Yeah, absolutely.
And with Silke's story, maybe it can be seen as tapping in a little bit to all these brave, educated celebrities who are coming out and saying, I've been sexually abused. Now, if they were shamed into keeping quiet, well, what chance does a 16, 18-year-old girl have of ever being able to express the shame and horror that she's endured?
Yeah.
This young girl became a loving, compassionate, caring woman. She was the bravest person that Lally ever met. She fought the horrors of her endurance and she came through it.
Well, it's an extraordinary story, Heather, and it's been good to talk to you again on the programme this morning, and no doubt we'll do it again another time. But in the meantime,
I love that.
Yeah, likewise. I wish you well, and thanks for chatting today. All the best for now.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Heather. Heather Morris is the author of Silke's Journey. That's C-I-L-K-A-S. It's a very striking cover. You'll see it in your bookshop. Previously, The Tattooist of Auschwitz being Heather's other big book. And I think that'll be of great interest to people listening in this morning. It's 5 to 10.